Numbers chapter 28 and 29 tonight. That's right, you heard me. Two chapters. No problem, piece of cake. So this is the Lord's last minute refresher course on the offerings and the holy days from the law of Moses. You're going to notice in these two chapters that God is not dealing with individual offerings. This is not about the people individually bringing offerings for themselves. What the Lord is dealing with in these two chapters are national offerings and then national holy days. So this is all collective level stuff. This is for the nation. This is like, you know, related to us. It's the church. It's the group of God's people that we're dealing with. So though you can take and break all of this down and glean from this personal lessons for application on the individual level, the truth is that these chapters actually speak more about the corporate or collective status of God's people. Now, this is all aimed, of course, at the second generation of the nation of Israel. And as I shared with you coming into this service, you know, this is stuff that we completely covered already. This was Leviticus chapter 23. Why did we cover it? Because the Lord shared these same things with the first generation. They didn't do the right thing with what the Lord shared with them. But here we are now for the second generation. So the Lord is going over these things again, but it's the first time, really, that the second generation is hearing it. So since we have studied these things, and some of this stuff many multiple times, we aren't going to spend a whole lot of time digging through the specifics. Now, there are a lot of specifics in these two chapters. These are actually the two most complicated chapters in the book of Numbers because it's dealing with this stuff, offering stuff, very specific stuff, very detailed stuff. And we're going to move through this quite a bit more quickly. We're not going to spend a whole lot of time digging through specifics. Those are things we already know that we've already studied very recently. We are going to talk about some of the typological things that emerge from the two chapters, but I guarantee you we're not going to squeeze all the typological juices out of these two chapters. So there's more here. Much of it we've already covered, perhaps some that we haven't shared yet in our Wednesday night settings, but what we're going to do is mostly hit this at 40,000 feet. Bird's eye view. Well, okay, plane's eye view. Birds don't fly 40,000 feet. But so that means a lot of summarizing and a lot of just pulling away from those summaries interpretations for us to some degree. Should we do it that way? Or should we approach every one of these sections as if it's the first time we ever studied it? Well, that's a good question. It's one that I wrestle with all the time, every week, as we've been going through the five books of Moses, only at number four right now. We've been summarizing a lot lately. And the reason we're summarizing is because we've been over this stuff, and it was a short period of time ago that we went over it. So if we were slowing down to approach every section as if it was the first time we were approaching it, wow, would we be moving slow? We'd be like moving Sunday morning slow on our Wednesday evening studies. So instead of slowing us down for a lot of this ground that we've already covered, it's easier for me to say this is covered ground and then refer you back to that teaching for deeper study. And I think we're getting to the point where we need to break that pattern. This is not your fault. This is my fault. This is my teaching pattern, and I think it's time that we break that pattern. So I have an announcement for you tonight. A lot of prayer and thought has gone into this. I've asked other people to help me pray as well about our decision for our teaching plan on Wednesday night. And here's where I believe the Lord would have us be as a fellowship. Once we finish our last study in the book of Numbers, we are going to skip past the book of Deuteronomy temporarily. And then we're going to go straight to the book of Joshua. Now, Deuteronomy is an incredible book. I love the book of Deuteronomy. Jesus loved the book of Deuteronomy. During his temptation for 40 days in the desert, he whooped the devil with just the book of Deuteronomy. Every quote that he gave to Satan in that time of temptation came straight from this book. Jesus quoted from Deuteronomy constantly. The New Testament quotes from Deuteronomy regularly. But Deuteronomy, the name itself, the title of the book itself, comes from two Latin words, Deuteronomos, which means the second law, or properly translated, the second giving of the law. Do you understand what that means, church? That means the book of Deuteronomy is going to take us through all of the law of Moses again. And it's going to take us through the summary of the 40 years of desert wandering, the stuff that we just went through, right? Now, there is a lot of new material in Deuteronomy, wonderful material, stuff that you won't find elsewhere. But again, you have to dig through a lot of covered ground to get to the new ground. Now, that repetition is not boring for me. I love that. I could do that for the rest of my life, just going through the first five books of Moses over and over and over again. But my concern is that if we go through the book of Deuteronomy and go through all of this stuff again, that, well, familiarity breeds contempt, and the familiarity of it all might cause me, might tempt me to want to summarize and refer you back a little more than I should, and it might cause you, the familiarity of it all, to not get as much impact from the book of Deuteronomy as you rightfully should, because it is a powerful book. So with that said, you know, fresh is always better. Distance makes the heart grow fonder. So what I want to do is I want to distance us from the book of Deuteronomy. I want to distance us from the law of Moses for a while so that you all can recover, and that we on Wednesday nights can cover all new ground. Because that's what you begin when you hit the book of Joshua. Joshua, Judges, Ruth, 1 Samuel, 2 Samuel, that is all new ground. You won't hear me saying, once we get through Numbers, you won't hear me saying, well, we just covered this. No. All new ground throughout those books. Now, when you get to 2 Kings, 1 and 2 Kings, 1 and 2 Chronicles, now that is recovering ground from 1 and 2 Samuel. So that might be a good place for us to break up that monotony at that time. And come back and do what? Grab the book of Deuteronomy and tackle it fresh. As if you guys don't know anything about it. Because most of you are old enough that by the time we get there, you will have forgot about everything we studied in Genesis, Exodus, Leviticus, and Numbers. Yeah, you're right. That wasn't nice. So how does that sound for a teaching plan? Well, the Lord led me, so it doesn't matter if you like it or not. That's what we're doing. Now, there was a reason why I included Deuteronomy chapter 34 in conjunction with Numbers chapter 27. I did that intentionally to cover the death of Moses with that chapter, which brings it up, of course, so that once we finish Numbers chapter 36, really, the only thing we need to cover in the book of Deuteronomy is the death of Moses, and we will have done that. Once we get and finish chapter 36 of Numbers, we are going to be ready to watch Joshua lead the nation of Israel into the land of promise. So there you have it. That's what's coming up in our near future. But what's slated for tonight is Numbers chapter 28 and 29. And if we're going to get through it, we better get to it. So let's do that. Numbers chapter 28, verse 1. The Lord spoke to Moses, saying, command the people of Israel and say to them, my offering, my food for my food offerings, my pleasing aroma, you shall be careful to offer to me at its appointed time. And you shall say to them, this is the food offering that you shall offer to the Lord, two male lambs, a year old without blemish, day by day as a regular offering. The one lamb you shall offer in the morning, and the other lamb you shall offer at twilight. Also a tenth of an ephah of fine flour for a grain offering, mixed with a quarter of a hin of beaten oil. It is a regular burnt offering which was ordained at Mount Sinai for a pleasing aroma, a food offering to the Lord. Its drink offering shall be a quarter of a hin for each lamb. In the holy place You shall pour out a drink offering of strong drink, strong intoxicating wine, one of the biblical symbols for joy. You shall pour out this drink offering of strong drink to the Lord. The other lamb you shall offer at twilight, like the grain offering of the morning and like its drink offering. You shall offer it as a food offering with a pleasing aroma to the Lord. So first things first, in verses 1 through 8, God mandates a twice a day, burnt offering, grain offering, and drink offering. That's the summary of what we just read. Now, this, again, is a national thing. These aren't individual offerings. This is a national thing. So when we covered these same offerings as individual offerings, offerings that individuals would bring, you notice that we define the motivations and the meanings for those offerings at that time. The burnt offering, that symbolized consecration, or if you prefer the words, dedication, commitment to God. The grain offering symbolized fellowship with God, or if you prefer, relationship with God. And then the drink offering, essentially all that does is it drives the point home. It adds the life and the joy to whatever offering that you couple together with that drink offering. So just to work through that real quickly, what that looks like with the burnt offering and the grain offering. Burnt offering means what? Total dedication to God, total consecration. So if you're adding a drink offering to that, you get a fuller picture now. What that means put together is it means an entire life that is joyously poured out in dedication to God. The grain offering means fellowship with God. So couple that together with the drink offering. Now you have an entire life that is joyously poured out in fellowship with God. At the individual level, these were all free will, volitional, voluntary offerings. Do you remember that? I told you, God wasn't forcing any individual to be dedicated to Him. He never does. He wasn't forcing any individual to have fellowship with Him. Again, He never does. But now you notice the difference when we move to the national offerings. These offerings are no longer free will. They're no longer up to the people. They are mandatory. God makes them mandatory in this chapter, all of them. Now, that is not a double standard on God's part. That is simply a natural build upon free will. It's similar to us in the church saying, look, no one in this church building today has to get saved. Oh, but you got saved? Okay, well, now that you're saved, you need to attend church. You need to be dedicated to God. You need to do certain things that are Christ-like. And that's sort of the same thing we see here. God working with dedicated individuals that are in fellowship with Him and now making these offerings mandatory. So, for just a moment, let's forget about the hundreds and thousands of individual offerings that would be brought to the tabernacle on a daily basis and on an as-is-needed basis. And what we're seeing from this first daily mandatory national offering is God wanting to see from the whole nation a national level of dedication to Him in general, and a national interest in relationship with Him. We talked about this on the individual level. We drew those lessons that basically this is the equivalent for the New Testament Christian starting the day with God and ending the day with God, and doing your best throughout your busy day to serve and love and obey the Lord at all points in between. Now, that is a very good practice for a New Testament Christian. Start your morning with the Lord and your day with the Lord. It's all about your commitment to Him and your living, breathing relationship with Him. But the wonderful thing that we are taught about these sacrifices, because of how specific God is with this sacrificial Old Testament system, is it gives us the right focus when it comes to this daily morning and evening routine with God. It gets our minds, our faces, our hearts, and our fixations away from our efforts and onto our sacrifice for sin. You see, this daily dedication to God and recognition of fellowship with him, it was not based on the dedication of the people or the ability of the people to relate to God in a relationship. It was based upon the substitutionary sacrifices that were made so that those two things could happen, dedication to God and fellowship with him. Now, in the Old Testament, for them, it was that sacrifice of the bull or the lamb or the goat or whatever the case might be. That was the focus of their dedication and their fellowship. This makes what I am committing to God or enjoying with God possible. And of course, in the New Testament, that is all made possible to us through our perfect lamb that was slain for our sins. So you see, that gets the attention and the focus and the fixation off of how dedicated I am to God and how committed I am to fellowship with him. And it gets our focus where it needs to be. Christ made that possible. The only reason I am as dedicated as I am to the Lord and you too is because of the sacrifice of Christ, his work on your behalf. He was your substitutionary sacrifice. He made that possible. The relationship that you enjoy with God, that is 100% because of your sacrifice for sin, Jesus. Now, of course, on top of all of this, and by the way, I recognize I'm trying to teach fast and not talk fast. Is that a thing? I'm trying for it, so that's what I'm trying to do here. But one more thing before we move on. These things that we're reading, all of them serve as larger types for Christ, and I'm not going to pull them all out tonight, but I do want to mention this, that this consecration offering and this grain offering, it gives us a higher type that points us to Christ, in that Christ uniquely is the consecrated one. There's problems, there's issues with our consecration to God, not his. Jesus said in John chapter 8, verse 29, I always do those things that please the Father. Wouldn't you love to be able to say that? All I can really say is most of the time, I try to do the things that please the Father. Jesus could say, no, that is always the case for me. I never mess that up. And when we're talking about fellowship with the Father, again, Jesus is the fulfillment of this. He set the bar for fellowship with the Father. He said in John chapter 10, verse 30, I and the Father are one. You can't get closer to a person than to be one with the person. The wonderful thing is that Jesus prayed in John chapter 17 that all of us, every one of us believers, might have that same oneness that Christ had with his Father. So these are the daily offerings and what they communicate, twice a day, national level stuff. And now we move to the weekly offerings. Verse 9. On the Sabbath day, so that is every Saturday, two male lambs, a year old without blemish, and 2/10 of an ephah of fine flour for a grain offering mixed with oil and its drink offering. This is the burnt offering of every Sabbath besides the regular burnt offering and its drink offering. So verses 1 through 8, They were to daily offer up morning and evening a burnt offering, a grain offering, and a drink offering to communicate their commitment to God and their desire for fellowship with him. But now, verses 9 and 10, in addition to that daily national offering, we have a weekly burnt offering, grain offering, and drink offering. And this is in order to say that once a week, that seventh day, that Sabbath day, that Saturday, is unique and special above the rest of the days of the week. The nation commits itself to God daily, even in spite of the hecticness of their lives. You know what that feels like, right? Trying to be committed to God, serving him and obeying him in spite of your hectic schedule. But once a week on that Sabbath, everyone got to slow down. They got to rest. They got to forget about work. Praise the Lord. And they got to make that day all about God. It was a day to catch up. So that Old Testament principle though it's an Old Testament principle, it's very good for New Testament saints because daily time with God is almost always contested. Am I right? I know I'm right. You just can't wake up and have your head in the clouds all day. Oh, Lord, you're so wonderful. Oh, look, it's noon. Oh, Lord, you're so wonderful. 4 o'clock. No, you got, maybe you have the kids. You got to get them breakfast and off to school. Maybe you got the dog that you have to let out. Maybe you got to get off to work at a certain time. And when you get to work, you probably have to actually work. So all day, we admit it. We don't like it, but we admit it. All day can't be about just head in the clouds with the Lord. No, our time daily is contested. That's why once a week, that special occasion where we cordon off that day just for the Lord, just for relaxation, for worship, for reflection, for recuperation. That's why that's so important. You know, here at Anchored Fellowship, because we've talked about this probably 20 times since I've been a pastor here. It just seems to keep coming up, Old Testament and New Testament, that I am a serious proponent of a Christian observing some form of the Sabbath, taking one day a week that you block off. And I know friends are going to try to get you to do stuff for them and with them. Block that day off. Stick to that as best as you can. Don't let that day on your calendar fill up. Don't use that day as the day to get caught up on your to-do list. As much as you can, as best as you can, make that a day where you can get caught up with all of that time that you missed with the Lord throughout the week. A day where you can just relax, rest, and enjoy the Lord. And maybe family too. All right, so we have daily offerings, verses 9 and 10. Weekly offerings, what do you guess is next? Monthly, wow, you guys are good. You must have studied ahead. Monthly offerings is next, you're correct. So, verse 11. At the beginnings of your months, you shall offer a burnt offering to the Lord, 2 bulls from the herd, 1 ram, 7 male lambs, 1 year old without blemish. Also, 3/10 of an ephah of fine flour for a grain offering mixed with oil. For each bull, and 2/10 of the fine flour for a grain offering mixed with oil for the 1 ram, and 1/10 of fine flour mixed with oil as a grain offering for every lamb, for a burnt offering with a pleasing aroma, a food offering to the Lord. Their drink offering shall be 1/2 hin of wine for a bull, 1/3 hin for a ram, and 1/4 hin for a lamb. This is the burnt offering of each month, throughout the months of the year. Also 1 male goat for a sin offering to the Lord. It shall be offered besides the regular burnt offering and its drink offering. So now this is a monthly national or collective dedication to God, commitment to fellowship with Him. The drink offering that adds the life and the joy to it. This wasn't a drudgery, but there's something else in here. There's something different in the monthly one, right? Did you catch it? What is it? It's a sin offering. That's different. What do you suppose that means, a sin offering? It means that the Lord has set up here a good routine section of time for us to come back and examine our lives, giving special attention to detecting sin and then reflecting on God's forgiveness for sins. So within that space of a month, the routine kind of works like this. You go about a month and you're probably going to be able to then, you know, at the end of that month, reflect back, think of some moments where you weren't super committed to the Lord and didn't do all that well in your fellowship with Him. Moments and actions of sin and failure, and that's a good set apart time, a good routine time to examine yourself for those things, detect those things, confess those things, and then rejoice in the Lord's forgiveness for those things. It's basically like the monthly visit to the spiritual chiropractor to get you all straightened up, you know? So, guess what, church? That's exactly what communion is for us, isn't it? Aren't those the things we reflect on during communion? Lord, I'm examining myself. I'm looking for sin. If I find it, I'm confessing those sins. I want my relationship with you to be good. I want my dedication to you to be good, Lord. I want to be right with you right now in this moment so that I can celebrate forgiveness of sins through the body and the blood of Christ. Did you think it was happenstance that here at Anchored Fellowship we celebrate communion once a month? Did you think we picked that out of thin air? No, we actually cheated. We actually fell back to this Old Testament pattern, this Old Testament routine that's given to us that collectively, although it's something I encourage you to do daily as an individual, but collectively as a group of God's people, as a church, it's a good idea for us once a month to reflect back, to detect sin, and then to rejoice in God's forgiveness of sins. When did they do this? Look at verse 15 again. The first of every month. When do we celebrate communion here at this fellowship? The first Sunday of every month. You didn't know that? That's first you're hearing it? That's when we do it. So again, we cheated. We're not under the Old Testament law. That's not why we do it. But the Lord came up with this. So of course it's good. So we're borrowing it in the New Testament. All right, so we have daily, we have weekly, we have monthly. What's next? Of course, yearly. And now here's where things change. Now that we come to these yearly offerings, these annual offerings, these are going to be known as the feast days or the festivals, the holy days, or as we would say, holidays, right? That's holidays means holy days. Hopefully you know that. If not, you do now. So, in other words, these are for the whole nation, and they are on Israel's national calendar. So there are seven of them: the Feast of Passover, the Feast of Unleavened Bread, which is often rolled in together with the Feast of Passover because it begins the day after Passover, the morning after. Then you have the Feast of First Fruits. You have the Feast of Weeks, which occurred 50 days after the Feast of First Fruits. Therefore, it is also known as Pentecost, because Pentecost, Greek word, means 50 days, right? Then you have the Feast of Trumpets. Then you have the Day of Atonement. And then last of all, the Feast of Booths or the Feast of Tabernacles. So those are the holy days that we're going to look at real quickly here. That's chapter 28 and 29. That's what the rest of this, these two chapters cover. So first, the Feast of Passover, verse 16. On the 14th day of the first month, and if you remember back to Exodus chapter 12, this was actually not the first month of their civil calendar. The Lord had them stop and basically create a religious calendar at that time when he was leading them out of the nation of Israel. So if I was the nation of Israel, I think I would have abandoned the civil calendar and I would have just went with the religious calendar. But the nation of Israel historically has chosen to run two calendars. They have a civil calendar and they have a religious calendar. So this is on the religious calendar. It starts their year. The year for the nation of Israel should revolve around their relationship with God and everything that entails. So on the 14th day of the first month is the Lord's Passover. One verse about Passover. But don't worry, the Lord has covered it in great detail multiple times by the time that you get to Numbers chapter 28. So I promise you, the people of Israel, they knew what to do on Passover at this time. Passover was all about redemption, which means to buy back at a cost. So we studied this in Exodus chapter 12. God redeemed the nation of Israel through the blood of the lambs. Exodus chapter 12, verse 23, here's what it says. When the Lord saw the blood of the lamb applied to the doors of their homes, he would cause the destroyer, the death angel, to pass over that home, not kill that home. They got to live. And that's where the name Passover comes from, of course. Death passing over that home because of the blood of the lamb. Of course, you know, you have to know, Passover paints a powerful picture for the Christian. Christ is our Passover. We deserve spiritual death because of sin. But when the Father sees the blood of the Lamb applied to the doorposts of our hearts, what does he do? His judgment passes over us. Death does not get a grip on us. Spiritual death passes us right by. The blood of the Lamb gives us eternal life with the Father. So once a year, the Lord wanted collective focus on just that, their redemption, their deliverance. Boy, if we only had such a thing in the church, an annual day to reflect back on redemption. Well, that's right, we do. How about Good Friday? How about Resurrection Sunday, Easter? So again, different names, celebrated at different times, but the New Testament church once again finds itself sort of just following along with the Old Testament law and cheating from it a little bit. All right, next up, the Feast of Unleavened Bread, and this is verses 17 through 25. Verse 17, and on the 15th day of this month is a feast. 7 days shall unleavened bread be eaten. On the first day there shall be a holy convocation, a gathering of the people. You shall not do any ordinary work, so it's a Sabbath, it's an off day. Don't go into the office that day. Verse 19, but offer a food offering, a burnt offering to the Lord, 2 bulls from the herd, 1 ram, and 7 male lambs a year old. See that they are without blemish. Also their grain offerings of fine flour mixed with oil, 3/10 of an ephah shall you offer for a bull, and 2/10 for a ram. 1/10 shall you offer for each of the 7 lambs. Also 1 male goat for a sin offering to make atonement for you. You shall offer these besides the burnt offering of the morning, which is for a regular burnt offering. And you're going to keep seeing this statement over again that says that these offerings that I'm giving you now, they are on top of, they are in addition to the other offerings that you may have occurring on this same day. That's important to note because it means that all of these offerings and these feast days, if they're happening at the same time, all of those sacrifices that the Lord called for, they're stackable. They're not replaceable. You don't say, well, today's Feast of Unleavened Bread, it's also the first day of the month, but we're not going to do the monthly thing or the weekly thing if it falls on the same day because, well, this sort of takes precedent. No, it all stacks. It all adds up. So hypothetically, if you had an annual holiday that fell on the first day of the month and the first day of a week, well, then you would do the daily offerings. You would do the weekly offerings, the monthly offerings, and then that yearly offering. You would have to do all of those offerings on that same day. Verse 24, in the same way you shall offer daily for 7 days the food of a food offering with a pleasing aroma to the Lord. It shall be offered besides the regular burnt offering and its drink offering. And on the 7th day you shall have a holy convocation. You shall not do any ordinary work. So again, unleavened bread followed immediately after, the day after Passover. It is what came next logically. Passover, the Lord was passing over their sins. He was breaking them free. But logically, the next thing was unleavened bread. Unleavened bread was where the Lord then what? Led the nation out. He didn't just set them free and leave them in place. He set them free, but then he took them out of Egypt. Now, originally, when that first Passover and then unleavened bread happened, you remember the story. The Lord said, you are going to be in a rush. You're going to do the whole Passover thing. The firstborn of the nation of Egypt are going to die. And when they're ready for you to go, believe me, they're ready for you to go. And you're going to need to go quick. So you're not going to have time to leaven your bread. Your bread doesn't have time to rise. So the Lord had them make unleavened bread. That was the beginning of it. But now we start to piece together the truths that we find from that, the types that build from that. And what we have commemoratively is that God would have the nation to reflect back on that first day of unleavened bread and celebrate it by combing through their homes intentionally and carefully, looking for any leaven that might be found in the home. And they were to try to get rid of that leaven. The home was to be completely free of leaven during those 7 days of the Feast of Unleavened Bread. And man, what a picture that paints. What a truth and a type that brings forward for the Christian, because leaven is symbolic for sin. So unleavened bread follows the Passover. Here's what that means for the church. If Passover represents salvation, then the next logical step of being broken free, being set free, the next logical step of actually moving out and going to the place where the Lord wanted you, what would that represent? Passover represents salvation. What does unleavened bread, moving out, mean? It means sanctification. It means the cleaning up of your walk in Christ. So that is where the Lord takes those 7 days, so to speak. Seven is the number of completion. So the Lord saves you, but he doesn't just save you to leave you there and continue in the sins that were destroying you and will destroy you. He doesn't just save you to leave you stuck in sin, but he saves you to set you free from sin. That's what sanctification is. It is the daily breaking of the power of sin in your life. The Lord does a complete work in that regard. 7 days, that's the picture of completeness. It's going to take you more than 7 days to get sanctified, though. So don't get your hopes up. How long is it going to take you? Well, on the day you die, and I do your funeral, if I'm still alive, I'm going to say that person is finally sanctified. That's how long sanctification takes. Romans chapter 6, verses 1 and 2, Paul said, "What shall we say then? Are we to continue in sin that grace may abound? God forbid, by no means. Of course not." The Lord set you free to sanctify you from sin. All right, the Feast of First Fruits, verses 26 through 31. "On the day of the first fruits, when you offer a grain offering of new grain to the Lord at your Feast of Weeks, you shall have a holy convocation. You shall not do any ordinary work, but offer a burnt offering with a pleasing aroma to the Lord, 2 bulls from the herd, 1 ram, 7 male lambs a year old, also their grain offering of fine flour mixed with oil, 3/10 of an ephah for each bull, 2/10 for 1 ram, 1/10 for each of the 7 lambs, with 1 male goat to make atonement for you. Besides the regular burnt offering and its grain offering, you shall offer them and their drink offering. See that they are without blemish." Now, interestingly, the Lord joins together two feasts in this section, verses 26 through 31. He gives us, combined together, the Feast of First Fruits and the Feast of Weeks. Now, that does make sense because these are both harvest festivals. The Feast of First Fruit takes place in spring, and then the Feast of Weeks takes place 50 days later, and that would be the full first harvest, so summer. First fruits, spring, Feast of Weeks, summer. The Feast of First Fruits is the anticipation of the coming harvest. That's what it is. It's where you start to see the fruit of harvest in early spring. And what Israel would do is they would cut down some of those early crop pieces is not the right word. Early portions of, don't laugh at me, early portions of crops. And then they would wave that to the Lord and say, "Thank you, Lord, because this means something good is coming," right? My tomatoes are starting to come in. I got a few potatoes here and there. Lord, it's looking good. There's life in my garden. That means hope, anticipation. There's a full harvest coming, and it's going to be something that the Lord does. Well, then you have the Feast of Weeks, or Pentecost. And that was the realization of that first harvest. So what you were hoping for, what you were anticipating in the Feast of First Fruits, that was the full realization of that. You brought that full harvest in, and you could say, "Wow, Lord, you came through. You met my expectations. All of that hope that I had for a big crop, Lord, you really delivered." Now, there are a handful of different ways that we could practically apply this, but I'm going to leave that for you to do because we are quickly running out of time. So let's hurry into chapter 29, where we now come to the Feast of Trumpets, and that is in verses 1 through 6. Let's take a look. Verse 1, "On the first day of the 7th month, you shall have a holy convocation. You shall not do any ordinary work. It is a day for you to blow the trumpets. And you shall offer a burnt offering for a pleasing aroma to the Lord, one bull from the herd, one ram, seven male lambs, a year old without blemish. Also their grain offering of fine flour mixed with oil, 3/10 of an ephah for the bull, 2/10 for the ram, and 1/10 for each of the seven lambs, with one male goat for a sin offering to make atonement for you, besides the burnt offering of the new moon and its grain offering, and the regular burnt offering and its grain offering, and their drink offering, according to the rule for them, for a pleasing aroma of food offering to the Lord. The Feast of Trumpets that we just read about in verses 1 through 6 is also referred to in the Bible as the Feast of Ingathering. Now, that's a very significant detail. This also is a harvest festival. It is the late and last harvest of the year. So this was the fall harvest around September or October. So this was happy time. This meant all of the farm work, all the agricultural stuff for the year is done. It's all in the barn. There's nothing left to do but simply to kick back and enjoy the fruit of all of that labor. Typologically, it refers to the rapture of the church, very specifically, the rapture of the church. The name of this feast pretty much gives it away. Feast of Trumpets or Feast of Ingathering. What is the rapture? That is the moment in time where the Lord ends the church age and ingathers the church. So all of that harvest work that he is doing currently in the age of the Gentiles, in the church age, he's going to bring all of that work to an end. That is going to be the final harvest of the church age. And how does he sound off that ingathering, that time of ingathering, that rapture moment? How does he sound it off? With the blast of a trumpet, the trumpet of God, and then the dead in Christ arise first, and those who are alive and remain will be caught up to be together with him forever in the clouds. So, beautiful picture of the rapture of the church through metaphors where the Lord finally, once and for all, gathers his wheat from the church age into his barn. Now, don't go telling everyone the Lord's going to have you living in a barn in heaven. It's just metaphors. Actually, you know what? For some of you, he just might keep you in the barn. I don't know. But I know that the Lord tells us in John 14, I go to prepare a place for you. In my Father's house are many dwelling places. And those dwelling places that the Lord is taking us to are specifically created for us. So in that case, I may be in a barn. I've always liked farming, so that just might be my place. Well, next we have the Day of Atonement, verses 7 through 11. On the 10th day of this seventh month, you shall have a holy convocation and afflict yourselves. Underline that, afflict yourselves. You shall do no work, but you shall offer a burnt offering to the Lord, a pleasing aroma, one bull from the herd, one ram, seven male lambs a year old. See that they are without blemish, and their grain offering shall be of fine flour mixed with oil, 3/10 of an ephah for the bull, 2/10 for the one ram, 1/10 for each of the seven lambs, and one male goat for a sin offering, besides the sin offering of atonement, underline that word, atonement, and the regular burnt offering and its grain offering and their drink offering. So the word atonement, of course, is what gives us the name of this feast day or holy day, the Day of Atonement. It's Yom Kippur in the Hebrew language. It was the only Israeli festival where the high priest did all of the work on that day. The rest of the priest didn't help at all. It was the high priest that had to carry all of the heavy hitting, just like Jesus, our high priest, did for us. It's a wonderful picture of Christ's death for sin on the cross, his death and even his resurrection. The whole thing just pictures beautifully all of that. Christ did all of the heavy hitting. He did all of the work by himself. You didn't help him in order to save you. He didn't need you. You just would have gotten in the way, like working with my dad when I was younger. I just got in the way. He did all of that work for you, and that is what the Day of Atonement is all about. It is also the only Israeli festival that was not a joyous occasion. Every other feast day, oh, it was celebration. It was happiness. Even if you were, you know, examining the soul for sin, it was all glorious stuff. Times of great celebration for the nation. But on the Day of Atonement, surprising, the Lord says, on this day, I want you to be bummed out. I want you to afflict your souls. I want you to be depressed over your sins as a nation. So it was all about agonizing reflection. Atonement, which means to make at-one-ment with. It means to set things right. It's about final judgment, ultimate judgment. And what it does is it gives us some pretty precise detail about the crucifixion, burial, resurrection of Christ. Too many to dive into tonight. I wish we could, but I'll just leave you with this. It seems like there's a lot of overlap between the Passover and the Day of Atonement. Did you ever like compare those two and think, well, aren't they just kind of telling us the same thing? Aren't they showing us the same Christ and the same act of sacrificial life-giving to save us? Well, certainly there is some overlap between Passover and the Day of Atonement as you're looking for general types about Christ, but there are differences. There is a separateness to these two feasts. And I think typologically, when we're looking at the Day of Atonement, the tribulation fits very well here. Because whereas Passover is the joyous celebration of Christ's deliverance, the Day of Atonement is set in somber tones. It's about affliction. Another word for affliction is trouble, trial, or tribulation. And the Day of Atonement is about setting things right. It's about final judgment. Of course, we know that is when the Lord begins to work on those things. The tribulation period, the seven-year period of tribulation, is known as the time of Jacob's trouble. In other words, the period of Israel's affliction. It is when the nation of Israel is going to be afflicted in their souls over their sins, specifically the sin of not believing in their Messiah who came to save them and laid down his life for them. And it is during that period where the Lord makes that atonement with the nation of Israel, and of course for Gentiles as well, that will be saved during the tribulation. And at the end of that, at the end of those 7 years, you have everything once and for all at one-ment with Christ, set perfectly straight with him. At his second coming, we're ushered into the millennial kingdom of Christ, where he rules and reigns perfectly. And at the end of that, there's a final judgment, but there's no uprisings ever again. There's no, you know, 50% sinners and 50% saints. He reigns perfectly from that time forward. So we're running out of time here. I'll let you run with the rest of that on your own personal time, but let's take a look at this final feast, the Feast of Booths, or the Feast of Tabernacles, verses 12 through 40. On the 15th day of the seventh month, you shall have a holy convocation. You shall not do any ordinary work, and you shall keep a feast to the Lord 7 days, and you shall offer a burnt offering, a food offering with a pleasing aroma to the Lord, 13 bulls from the herd, 2 rams, 14 male lambs a year old. They shall be without blemish. And their grain offering of fine flour mixed with oil, 3/10 of an ephah for each of the 13 bulls, 2/10 for each of the 2 rams, and 1/10 for each of the 14 lambs. Also 1 male goat for a sin offering besides the regular burnt offering, its grain offering, and its drink offering. On the second day, 12 bulls from the herd, 2 rams, 14 male lambs a year old without blemish, with the grain offering and the drink offerings for the bulls, for the rams, and for the lambs in the prescribed quantities. Also 1 male goat for a sin offering, besides the regular burnt offering and its grain offering and their drink offerings. On the third day, 11 bulls, 2 rams, 14 male lambs, a year old without blemish, with the grain offering and the drink offerings for the bulls, for the rams, and for the lambs in the prescribed quantities. Also 1 male goat for a sin offering, beside the regular burnt offering and its grain offering and its drink offering. On the 14th day, 10 bulls, 2 rams, 14 male lambs, a year old without blemish, with the grain offering and the drink offerings for the bull, for the rams, and for the lambs in the prescribed quantities. Also, one male goat for a sin offering, besides the regular burnt offering and its grain offering and its drink offering. On the fifth day, 9 bulls, 2 rams, 14 male lambs, a year old without blemish, with the grain offering and the drink offering for the bulls, for the rams and for the lambs in the prescribed quantities. Also, 1 male goat for a sin offering, besides the regular burnt offering and its grain offering and its drink offering. On the sixth day, aren't you glad we're going to Joshua next? The book of Joshua. On the sixth day, 8 bulls, 2 rams, 14 male lambs, a year old without blemish, with the grain offering and the drink offerings for the bulls, for the rams, and for the lambs in the prescribed quantities. Also, 1 male goat for a sin offering, besides the regular burnt offering, its grain offering, and its drink offering. On the seventh day, 7 bulls, 2 rams, 14 male lambs, a year old without blemish, with the grain offering and the drink offerings for the bulls, for the rams, and for the lambs in the prescribed quantities. Also, 1 male goat for a sin offering, besides the regular burnt offering, its grain offering, and its drink offering. On the eighth day, you shall have a solemn assembly. You shall not do any ordinary work, but you shall offer a burnt offering, a food offering with a pleasing aroma to the Lord, 1 bull, 1 ram, 7 male lambs, a year old without blemish, and the grain offering and the drink offerings for the bull, for the ram, and for the lambs in the prescribed quantities. Also, 1 male goat for a sin offering, besides the regular burnt offering and its grain offering and its drink offering. These you shall offer to the Lord at your appointed feast, in addition to your vow offerings and your freewill offerings, whatever comes up personally and individually, for your burnt offerings and for your grain offerings and for your drink offerings and for your peace offerings. And verse 40, so Moses told the people of Israel everything just as the Lord had commanded Moses, and he told us to. So, you will notice the instructions for the Feast of Tabernacles is quite a bit daunting. Did you notice? It goes from verse 12 to verse 40. That is a lot of verses. And the reason why is that this is an 8-day festival, and for every day, the offering is different. So you had to go through each day and give us the different offerings. The number of slain lambs, you probably noticed, is the same every day. 14 slain lambs every single day. You'll notice the big change there was in the amount of the bulls. That changed daily. So, you've no doubt heard the song, The 12 Days of Christmas. Well, what we just read through was the 8 days of tabernacles. And it looked like something like this. Verse 13, on the first day of tabernacles, my true loves gave to me 13 bulls. Verse 17, on the second day of tabernacles, 12 bulls. Verse 20, on the third day of tabernacles, 11 bulls. Verse 23, on the fourth day of tabernacles, 10 bulls. Verse 26, on the fifth day of tabernacles, my true loves gave to me 9 brownish bulls. Probably should have picked a different key. Verse 29, on the sixth day of tabernacles, 8 bulls. Verse 32, on the seventh day of tabernacles, 7 bulls. Verse 35, on the eighth day of tabernacles. Okay, now everything changes. Because this is the final day, everything is different. It's just 1 bull, and instead of 14 lambs, that changes down to 7 lambs. Now, it is my best guess that the decreasing number of bulls there each day was symbolic of them getting closer and closer to the land of promise. So you start with 13, you work your way down. By the time you get to the eighth day, which is the day of a new beginning, that's the day of symbolically their arrival into the land of promise. Now you don't need those extra bulls. It's just the 1 bull for that day because of their arrival in the land. Now, those are some specifics, and there's lots more in there. Do you want to cover them, or should we close and go home? I think we should close and go home, okay? So, in closing, let me just pull back really quickly and have us take a look at the big picture here. The Feast of Tabernacles was established by God so that the nation of Israel would honor those 40 years of desert wandering from the first generation. Yes, it's true that after the second generation passed along, there would be no one in the nation of Israel that was actually present for those 40 years of desert wandering. And yet the Lord did not want them to forget what their ancestors went through and what they experienced with the Lord. So the way to do that was to give them this 8-day festival called the Feast of Tabernacles, to once a year bring these experiences and these remembrances back of the miracle provisions of God during those 40 years for their ancestors. And to that end, the Lord has commanded them for 8 days to camp out outside of their homes. They were to build their own tabernacles or booths or lean-tos, and they were to camp out overnight in those lean-tos for 8 days. The focus of this feast was that living that way in the desert is impossible unless God is your God. So what it was really meant to do was break continuously, year after year, the independence of the nation of Israel, independence from God. It was to break them from that, and it was to bring them into a state of dependence upon the only one that can truly provide for us in life and care for us and supply for us, and that would be God. For 40 years, it wasn't just a few families that the Lord managed to get through the wilderness. It was over 3 million people that the Lord somehow was able to find enough food and water to satiate, and he did. They did not lack. They complained because they thought they lacked. They didn't lack. They just got tired of the same diet, the manna. They complained of thirst. They were not dying of thirst. They were not dying of starvation. They never went without. The Lord more than provided for them for 40 years. Even their clothes didn't wear out for 40 years. So all of that is meant to break them of that need that is within fallen flesh to be independent from God. And I know that we think we are. I know that unbelievers that do not want to follow the Lord, they truly, God bless their mistaken souls, believe that they are independent from God. They are not independent from God. They just don't realize it. And we could prove that by asking the Lord to take a few months off and take his sun, his moon, his wind, and his rain with him. And then after 2 months of God on vacation with all of his good stuff, well, the rest of us would be toast, or I guess more accurately, popsicles. We need the sun. We need the moon. We need the wind. We need the rain. We need the Lord. He provides for us whether we realize it or not. It is foolish for us to get independent and think that we're the ones that are doing it, that our own survival and that our own well-being in life is totally in our hands. It's not. And so just like the nation of Israel with this feast, I would encourage you, embrace the truth about who it is that really takes care of you in life, about who it is that really, truly provides for you in life. One final point, and then we're out of here. The sheer number of annual sacrifices. I just wanted to give you this tally at the end, right? This is not counting any individual offerings that would be given during the time of these feasts or these daily or monthly or weekly sacrifices and offerings. But just the yearly national offerings that the Lord called for in these two chapters gives us a total of 1,086 lambs, 113 bulls, 37 rams, 30 goats, over a ton of flour, 378 gallons of wine and oil. It is a massive amount of offerings, an expensive annual amount of offerings that the nation would have to budget for. Thinking about the Board of Elders and what's coming at the turn of the year here, the budget, right? So this one final lesson is about the worth of salvation and the cost of salvation. The worth of salvation and full relationship with God is incalculable. And you know what? As far as the cost is concerned, the Lord determined that that cost was well worth it just to save us. The words of the prophet Isaiah in Isaiah chapter 53, verse 10, concerning the Father, he said this, "It pleased the Father to crush the Son and put him to grief in order to make an atonement for sin and guilt." Isn't the Lord incredibly merciful and wonderful to us? Let's stand on that note and just thank him in a closing word of prayer.